Welcome to episode 54 of Divergent Paths. I'm your host, Dan Dunford, and thank you for listening. Thank you for coming back or making this your first time. There's this spot between me introducing myself and then talking about the guests, and I never know what to put in that spot because I don't want to jump right into introducing the guests. I have things I want to talk about, but I never know how to do it. But this is obviously a terrible way, but you know what, it's real, and being real makes it worth it. I don't know. Anyway, might as well just get into talking about the guest. This week, guest on the podcast is Jen Baker, who is a really cool trombonist here in the city. And by the city, I mean New York City, obviously. And I know her through Dave Whitwell, through Will Lang. I played with her on a number of occasions. She's connected in the new music community in New York and has been doing a lot of contemporary work on trombone for a number of years, and really nice, wonderful person and a extremely good trombone player. But in addition to all that, she recently wrote a book entitled Hooked on Multiphonics. If you're a trombone player or a brass player, it's become more and more important to learn these contemporary techniques just to round out, your musicianship as a player. And because people are asking for these things more and more, and Jen has spent a good portion of her life studying these types of things, and so she's an excellent person to write a book about it. It's a really great resource. Once again, it's called Hooked on Multiphonics. Multiphonics and Other Extended Techniques Demystified. She spent a number of years working on it, a lot of time researching, collecting materials and writing text, but also writing examples and composing bits for the book. And it's really good. But me talking to her, it's not just about this book, and it's not just about extended techniques for brass instruments. Her story is interesting because, a lot of people that I talk to, it's pretty straightforward. You go to school, you finish school, you do that, you come to New York, or you finish school in New York, and you go on and you try do your things. And Jen's had a little bit of a more extended journey towards that, towards what she does now. And she has some interesting things to say about that, about taking a more roundabout route to your final destination. Who knows if this is her final destination or not, but kind of a more roundabout route, and talking about putting together such a daunting project as writing a book and getting it published, getting it edited. We talk through this whole process at length, and it was a lot of fun, and we had a good time, and there's some laughs, there's some serious stuff, and we, just generally, it was a good one. I was really happy, really, really happy with how it turned out. So I hope you enjoy it. If you're listening to this and you're not a brass player, I encourage you to listen to it. I have kind of an example of some of the things we're talking about, as far as extended techniques on trombone, from an album she recorded a number of years ago now. But at the end of the episode, there's a piece called Neptunian Love Song that kind of demonstrates like her expertise with multiphonics and how that, you know, kind of what that looks like when you're playing them on trombone. And yeah, so listen to that. That's from her album Blue Dreams, which I think she recorded in 2007. So yeah, and as always, you know, if you like the episode, please subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Share it around to people. I'm going to be doing a bit, you know, pushing this across Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And man, there's so many, you know, trombone groups on Facebook that I had no real concept of until, you know, a few months ago. And so I'll be pushing it across those. And again, you know, if you are able, hop over to my Patreon. It's patreon.com/divergentpathspod and consider giving a couple, you know, a dollar or two a month to help support the podcast and the videos. So I'm gonna be spending the next 2 to 3 days on Rikers Island filming for Mozart in the Jungle. So hopefully I make it back from one of the more notorious prisons in the country, you know, with nothing to show for it except for a paycheck. And yeah, so maybe I'll have something to say about that next week. Keep an eye out, you know, check out the YouTube channel, follow the links from either my Facebook page or go to YouTube and search Divergent Paths, pull up the speed round videos, pull up, episodes that you want to listen to. They're all up there, or they're all, yeah. So yeah, anyway, talk to you next week. And, you know, I one more thing. I realized I had finished recording, and I just realized that I didn't even mention where to get the book. So, Hooked on Multiphonics by Jen Baker. You know, she's going to be pushing it to, you know, what we talk about in the interview, she'll be pushing it to a few places in the near future. But right now, go to jenbakersounds.com and click the link at the top of the page that says Multiphonics, and you can buy her book directly from her. So yeah, that's it. Now enjoy the episode. Slow down. Great. So, awesome. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Dan.
I'm glad we could sit down. I mean, as a younger guy, it's funny. I'm a younger, obviously, not necessarily younger, but a trombonist who hasn't been around as long.
Mm-hmm.
Fine. I have a tendency to like get a little bit just like nervous around specific trombone players who have just been around longer, but I share gigs with, and I get nervous. So,
well, I'm nervous because I have to talk and say something intelligent. So
it's cool. Well, I mean, it was just like when I first asked you about doing this, like, I don't know, 5 months ago, 4 or 5 months ago, and I was like, I'm like, come, I can force myself to be comfortable around people who don't play trombone. trombone players, it can be weird sometimes if you're on the same gig. But
it's ironic that we're talking about nerves right now because I'm having nerves.
This is gonna be
about
good.
Something else.
It's gonna be fantastic.
Yeah. And you're leading the way. You can lead the torch, yeah. And everything you do is supportive. So.
So, I mean. Well, let's just touch on it, like, briefly, like, up top, so we'll touch on it, and then we'll come back to it. Part of the reason we're talking right now is because you book that's basically hot off presses.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, there's one beside me, and there's still heat, steamy lines. It's like those animated steam lines coming off of it.
Yeah, I see it. Right there.
Yeah, it actually looked kind of like it on the cover. And this book, Hooked on Multiphonics, which most brass players will know what that means, but you know, like this very a niche technique that's just become so much more popular in original compositions for brass instruments and trombone over the last. I mean, it's been used. It's been a regular technique in contemporary music for 60 some years now. But now it's pretty. I don't know. It's hard to make a broad blanket statement, but it's difficult to run across pieces now that, like, brand new pieces that don't have at least some sort of element.
Right, right.
Even, you know, there's varying degrees to which it is used, but, you know, there's going to be something.
Yeah, a lot of composers are interested in what those in-between sounds are that instruments can make. So on the trombone with multiphonics, there's a lot of breadth for those in-between sounds, those non-traditional sounds. And I think even if composers don't know what exactly can work or not work, it's interesting enough for them to dive in just a little bit and try a taste, just a morsel, maybe if it's just one chord or one passage, just to see. And it's really fun to see how that progression has come across, especially the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. It seems like there's a lot more interest in doing it again.
And one, just there's, when it comes down to it, there's more players who can do it now than there have been in the past.
Exactly.
And more players who are interested in doing it than have been in the past. And, you know, when it comes down to it, like, a composer might just, like, write something that's absolutely ridiculous, and you kind of have to do it anyway.
Yeah. Actually, it's funny, Stuart Dempster, who's, he wrote the modern trombone, mm-hmm. and it was back in the 70s,
classic tome of 20th century trombone playing.
Exactly. He, I think he actually mentions it in his foreword. He shared an anecdote with me where he was in the 70s or 80s. He was invited to the first international trombone workshops. I think they were called workshops and not festivals, or festivals and not workshops. Anyway, they changed the name.
Right.
But at that point, nobody knew what they were doing, multiphonics, mm-hmm. and it was just like a group therapy session where people got together, they sat in a room and tried stuff out, and it was a really interesting time. And that went on for a few years. Each year, there would be an interested contingent of trombone players wanting to find out about this. And who knows, maybe it waned, or maybe enough of them learned it so that they could go back to their schools and teach their students. So I like to think that might have been where it started taking off for trombone players.
Mm.
And now trombone players, of course, are expected to be able to...
Right. If you're not, like, solidly in one community, that means you're going to be, like, bouncing across several, especially in New York. And... at least having a knowledge and a practical idea of how to do it. Even, you know, some people are going to be better at it. Some people are going to have an easier time with it, but it's something that you at least have to understand about. But you, live in Brooklyn, and there's horns because that's just how it is. But no, but, I mean, you as a working trombone player in the city, and you, how long have you been here?
7 years.
7 years, okay. You're a working trombone player, and I'm assuming teaching as well, doing some teaching as well.
Mm-hmm.
Much like a lot of the trombone players here in the city. Like, so this is, but unlike most trombone players, you decided to actually put together a resource for other people to use. Now, like, let's you know, let's trace back further than that. Even as far back as, like, why you started playing the trombone and where you came from.
Cool. Yeah. Like, well,
get that comic book origin story going.
Sure thing. You know, a lot of people, when they ask me why or who I saw playing the trombone or why I started playing it, I don't have any answers up front. But this summer I realized, when I was really little, maybe 6, maybe even 5 years old, my grandparents took me to the circus that was in town. And this is a big deal because my town is a town of 2,000 people. It had 2 stoplights.
Where is this?
Jonesville, Michigan.
Okay.
And my grandparents lived kind of in the metropolis part of, of Jonesville, and I lived way out in the boonies on a farm. So getting to go into town and watching with my grandparents the circus was a big event, and they were really excited to show me the animals and the trapeze artists. But what I was really excited about was way over in the corner, there were these pinstriped looking, is it called a pinstriped suit?
Mm-hmm.
And like white pants and these Dixie hats. And this Dixie band was playing, and I noticed the trombone player in that band, and it just looked like, I was just mesmerized. I was watching the slide moving around, and I was listening to this really exciting music that I thought, that I've never heard this before, and wow, they're here. They're here, mm-hmm. in my town. This is cool.
Yeah.
I don't really remember the elephants.
Did it come full circle because you ended up playing with, like, Big Apple Circus or something?
You'd think that happened. I have definitely done some experimental music, but I don't think I've played with animals yet. I played in a dance piece that had resemblance to animals. Each of the dancers had to dress up as animals. That's the closest I've gotten.
So, I mean... I didn't grow up in the tiny parts of the Midwest, but I spent like a good chunk of my life spending a lot of time in rural Indiana, which is like in the northern part of rural Indiana, so it's similar in a lot of ways, but you know, still the same kind of like high school band kind of track, mm-hmm. like until you know through high school and all that kind of thing, I would assume.
Absolutely. Like, started in sixth grade with the regular, you know, the sixth grade beginner band. And I didn't think much of it because it was one of maybe 20 extracurriculars I was doing just to fill the time in between the dark chasms of boredom. And
you weren't helping out on the farm?
Yeah, that didn't really happen. I seemed to find a way to stay home, not out on the farm. Yeah, so there's a lot of I had a lot of interests, and finally at one point I realized that I needed to do something different. And a friend of mine was at Interlochen Arts Academy, and he kept telling me how much fun I would have if I went there, and how much more like the people I am at Interlochen than I am in Jonesville. And thought, well, you know, what do I have to lose? I think it's identity defining in a lot of ways, to give yourself or to be given that opportunity to work in an artistic medium away from home, you know.
And in your case, it wasn't a situation like you're not coming from another country to go to Interlochen, and you're going across the state.
Sure. Yeah.
So that's
you know. Also true. It wasn't that big of a commute.
Yeah.
Comparatively. Although it was the biggest commute of my parents' life.
Yeah. Of course.
So it was a so I went there, and my very first trombone lesson was at Interlochen. Had a fantastic, fantastic first teacher. I couldn't possibly ask for more. And then went on and continued this idea that, well, I should back up and say that this first teacher of mine told me that I could do orchestral playing as a living if I wanted to play trombone, or I could be a freelance artist, which would mean I need to know jazz, and I need to play jazz and be comfortable with changes and all this. And while I was in high school, and I had only had like 3 lessons at that point ever, so I was like, yeah, I don't think I'm comfortable with jazz. Maybe I need to do orchestra. So by default, I followed the orchestral path for 8 years. Kind of amazing. I just kind of kept my head down and did it. But toward the end of it, I was starting to realize there was something very wrong. That for me, it wasn't resonating. And there was a point where it became so clearly wrong that I had to drop out from grad school and reassess what my relationship to the trombone and relationship to music was.
It's only now starting to become a thing where really open-minded teachers of young students will say that you don't have to do only one or the other necessarily.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
But you know, it's still a thing that like there's a bass trombonist I know who just finished his master's at Juilliard, and never ever thought he would do anything but orchestral music, and he did his undergrad at IU, his grad at Juilliard, which can't get really can't get two schools that are more invested in that type of playing. Definitely. And he came over to my place one day just to hang out and play, and he was like, "I just hate it so much. I hate it. I hate everything about it so much. And now I'm like 6 years of school of only playing this sort of thing." I mean, this is a to be fair, this is a topic that gets revisited when I talk to people a lot.
Oh God, I can't imagine.
Because I like, because I'm,
it's like trombone therapy.
I'm young and snarky, and I like railing against things, even though like it doesn't, what I say doesn't matter to most, you know, to people who have jobs. So, but yeah, like it's now, you know, especially in New York, it's strange to meet a trombone player. It's almost stranger to meet a trombone player who has kept that singularity of focus towards orchestral playing.
It's
as opposed to someone who's like just been burnt out and now just kind of like, well, I mean, you were playing in an orchestra earlier today,
and
I will be playing in an orchestra this weekend, you know, in Vermont. Mm-hmm. And it's just something we still do, but in smaller doses than we were originally led to believe we would be doing it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, there's something really great to be said for playing in orchestras, and I still love playing in orchestras. I think what I was bucking against personally during school was the realization that was dawning on me that would be what I did. That would be the only thing that I did. And I can't isolate myself to playing any single style. That would not be enough for me. So, even if it was a full plate, you know. So,
it's just one of those things. Like, and I think it happens in things other than trombone. But like, when you hit a certain point in your life, when you've gone far enough down a specific road, and you realize, oh, this is just what I do now. This is what I do forever. Like, I mean, I'm young enough. I'm a younger person. Whatever, but I've just started to kind of hit these like landmarks where I'm like, oh no, like I can't change things now. This is just who I am.
Oh. Oh, that's a bunch of crap. You can always change things.
Oh, of course, yeah.
You can always change things. It takes a lot of work, but you know what? Everything takes a lot of work.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll quote Cameron Crowe from the movie Vanilla Sky, like a movie that no one likes except for me. But he used lines like, "Every passing moment is another chance to turn it all around," and that's a cheesy ass line, but really resonates.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry. Back to you. So, I mean, you're. Where did you end up going and doing your college and grad stuff?
Well, a little bit of a story there. So, to start college, I got a brass quintet scholarship at Western Michigan University.
I didn't know that was a thing.
That was a thing. And it turns out that my parents really wanted me to stay in Michigan. And so I begrudgingly looked at schools in Michigan and found the school, and thanks to my teacher again. And
Western Michigan isn't terrible.
Oh, no. It's just that I was searching far and wide.
Oh, of course.
I wanted to look around the world. But, you know, just Michigan. Guildhall.
Hey, Mom, Dad, I'm going to London. Is that cool?
Well, that happened later.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
And I didn't ask.
Better to ask forgiveness than permission.
So after Western, I transferred midway to Oberlin Conservatory, which is really where I wanted to be going to school. And it turned out to be the exact right school for me.
Right.
And during that time, there are a lot of other things, a lot of extra, beyond the trombone, I shouldn't say extra trombone, but things that happened, like my theory teacher was really incredible, Randy Coleman. Some people know who he is and would agree with me that I've had this conversation with several people at different points. We weren't at Oberlin together, but we had him in common. That he kind of broke our brains open with theory and, but not music theory. It was a music theory class, but he brought in all kinds of philosophy to read. Way too much homework and way too much required concerts to go and review and music to listen to, and papers to write and books to read. And he promised us that he had cut back what he had done before, 10 years before.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, like...
But, you know, he overwhelmed us with information, and we had to figure out a way around it. And at that point, I realized that I hadn't actually been listening to people. And it was during his classes that I started learning how to listen, because things were happening too fast for me to pay attention to just read mm-hmm. a book or read what's on the board or just kind of understand why we were there.
Yeah.
I had to actually deeply listen. So I have to attribute his class to some amount of deep listening and improvisational ability that I started learning.
Mm-hmm. I mean, was it during this period... I just noticed there's a trombone slide, like, just, like, oh, chilling yeah. on the wall
it's
over there.
It's just chilling. Yeah.
That's really...
it's next to a branch that's 3 years old. It's a pine tree branch.
That's... Oh, my God. You put two new music, improvisational trombone players in the same apartment, and, like...
Yeah, things happen.
It's weird shit.
You just don't know what you're going to see. Yeah.
So, I'm definitely leaving all that in, too. No, but was it at this point that you started, like, looking into ways to use the trombone, like, in a different way? Or was it kind of... This is kind of, like, what's laying the groundwork for you to think about it in a different way, perhaps?
You know... I'd never thought about it before, but you're right. It actually was laying the groundwork for some things to start falling into place later. Mm. And one of those groundwork laying moments was when that same teacher was hosting an Oberlin in London program, which I happily went mm-hmm. to do, and studied more theory. Postmodernism was a big deal at that time, so we studied critical thinking around postmodernist architecture and music and theater and art and the history around London.
What like year wise? What kind of time frame are we talking about?
This is 1999,
okay.
I think.
Okay.
Around that time, and that was a really memorable experience to get to have a concentrated. It was a semester of the same students involved in the same class all day long and taking field trips together and really piecing together different components of what these theories mean and what it means to be postmodernist and what it means to be and experience all of these artistic mediums in London. So I brought back some ideas from that, and I think that time away from just excessive trombone playing was kind of what started moving ideas around. So not long after that, I had a conversation with Pauline Oliveros, and she was teaching at Oberlin as well. And I said to her, you know, Pauline, I'm really enjoying these classes. I'm taking some composition classes. I'm taking these new music theory classes, and I'm in this new music ensemble at Oberlin, and these are really great, and I didn't know these things existed.
Right.
Where could I go to do more of this? And again, this is like 1999-ish. And she said, you know, you don't really have that many choices, but I can tell you this, Mills College in Oakland, California is where you want to go.
Really?
That's going to give you the concepts and ideas, some more groundwork that you're looking for. I don't think I mentioned improvisation was part of that. I was interested in more... improvisational aspects of mm-hmm. music that don't have to do with jazz. They can be incidental to jazz, but mm-hmm. I was looking for something that wasn't straight out of the bebop tradition.
Yeah, less changes and more.
yeah. So I put that in the back burner. I was like, okay, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get a master's degree in orchestral trombone playing, and then I'm going to get a master's degree in this Mills College weird music thing, and it's gonna be great, and that's gonna be my plan. So I charged forward, and I thought, okay, I'm gonna get this done. Fell flat on my face because a few months it was like a year later, about a week or two into my master's program at Northwestern, I realized, forget it. I'm done. I've overdone myself. I can't keep studying orchestral tromboplane. So I quit.
It was funny. When I had a similarly strange like college route, but I transferred to Manus because my first school shut down the music program.
Oh no.
It was only when I was a junior. It wasn't a big deal. It wasn't like I had to start over. It's not like I had to start over or anything. But I did a year at Manus, got freaked out by New York, right? So I decided, like, oh, I have a lot of family in Chicago. I'll audition a bunch of schools in Chicago. And I ended up basically only auditioning at DePaul, but basically because I looked at the list for Northwestern, and I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, I don't want to do a bullshit orchestra audition to get into a school. I'm not going to play your fucking Lebedev. I'm not going to play your orchestral excerpts to get into a school. I'm going to play what I want to play. And you're going to have to deal with it. So, like, legitimately, the audition list was enough to shut me off on. And, I mean, I would have been, like, the worst Northwestern student ever.
I agree.
But, I mean, what I'm just saying. Like,
we're second worst.
Right. So, like, you saying that, like, really, really kind of, solidifies my wisdom,
yeah.
my choice. Obviously, like, I don't regret the choice that I made in, like, not going to Chicago and just, like, staying in New York, but it's just funny that kind of lines up exactly with why I just, like, chose, like, just cut them out entirely.
It's good to know when your intuition is right, right? Yeah. Well, my intuition was definitely wrong. I remember I had the flu when I auditioned, and I blame it on that. Like, my receptors were off. I was, like, playing with a fever and choking and coughing, and I was like, oh man, well, I'm done with that. I'm gonna go home now and sleep. And I don't remember anything about the audition at all. So
did you stick it out?
No.
Like, no, you like
I got a job at Starbucks and I stayed in town and played.
There like, was a... But you dropped out after 2 weeks?
Or about, like how... Yeah, right around well, it's kind of vague in my mind because I think the actual paperwork was done a couple months later, but my heart was gone. Like, my soul had already ended that thing. And the only things that I was really doing, I actually maintained contact with the students that I was playing with. I was in a brass ensemble and a brass quintet, and turned out they needed me to sub for the jazz ensemble and the contemporary music ensemble and one ensemble. So it just happened I was there doing the same things I would have been doing if I'd been getting a degree.
They paid you.
They didn't pay me.
Oh.
No, they didn't pay me, but I didn't have to pay also because I dropped out so quickly. And there's some circumstances around that why it turned out so that I didn't have to pay.
Well,
I don't want to go into that.
Yeah. I don't care. No, I'm but like, how long did you end up staying in that, like, kind of in that circle community?
I stayed there for, you know, I didn't really know what else to do at that moment, and my security blanket was kind of getting the job at Starbucks, and then continuing to play in the brass quintet and the brass ensemble.
Huh.
You just kind of have a. What was cool were those people, the people I was playing with were pretty spot on awesome, and I felt like they kind of helped me, they kind of carried me along that year, whether they knew it or not.
Yeah,
kind of kept me floating. And
you didn't have to pay to go to Northwestern.
Yeah. And you know, obviously I wasn't taking lessons, I wasn't taking any classes, but really it was just I was just treading water.
Yeah.
You know, and they knew it, and they were very, very considerate and sweet, just kind of letting me do what I needed to do. And I got out of there, I guess, a few months later, and I realized, wow, so my first master's degree idea just didn't work out. So how about if I move on to my second one and check out Mills? So I called them up. I talked to the head of the department and explained where I was and where my interest in Mills had come from. They're like, oh, you sound great. It sounds like you're exactly what the school is for. And why don't you just send us an audition tape? You don't even have to show up. You know, we'll listen to your tape, and you send us some an application, write an essay. It's like, okay, sure. So I actually I auditioned by tape. Or whatever recording medium was available at the time. I don't even remember. And but so that school is not so performance heavy. So it wasn't such a big deal that I was auditioning by tape.
Yeah, okay. So Mills College, like, there's some, like, buried, half-remembered something in my brain that has to do with Mills College, and I can't quite put my finger on it. You know, like, it's not a place that you hear about
yeah,
a lot.
You know,
But I know that, like, I know something about it, but I don't know what it is that
it's one of the things that it's most known for is electronic music and composition program. A bunch of luminaries of new music taught there, beginning with Mio, Darius mm-hmm. Mio, John Cage, Anthony Braxton, I think George Lewis at some point.
Oh, those schlubs.
And now, you know, I think Elvin Curran still makes it there mm-hmm. one semester a year. He used to, at least. And a lot of other European composers mm-hmm. come and do one semester a year. Zena Parkins from New York goes there one semester a year. And so there's a really wide breadth of teachers that they have. And John Cage, actually, in the 60s, you might not know this, but Mills College is an all-women's school at the undergraduate level. And it used to be an all-women's school. Is that the thing you
That's
know?
What I remember.
Yeah.
That's because I think I know, I have a friend who went there for his master's, and uh-huh. he was like, oh yeah, it's an all-women's school for undergrad.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
It's a very interesting place because of that. We can get into that later, though.
I'll bet. Oh, Jesus.
A lot of stuff goes on.
I don't think I even want to know.
I will tell you that one day I was walking by the campus center, and they were selling cookies for $2, and for men they were $3. I just love that. Oh, I wanted to buy cookies for my male friends just to spite them.
Jesus.
But anyway,
well,
I mean, it's cool. You know, they're testing the waters, I think,
in
what feminism is and what equal rights mean.
They gotta make up that.
They
gotta make up that 21 cents on the dollar somehow.
I know.
Might as well charge them an extra dollar for cookies. So
there you go. And
I'm cool with it. I'll pay the $3. Anyway, that's not the important part. So
it was John Cage in the 60s who petitioned the president and just, you know, put his foot down and said, look, this is the only school that's existent doing doing tape music and anything to do with electronic music, which I don't think they called it. I think they called it tape music at the time. And he really pushed hard and got them to agree to allow men in at the at the graduate level.
Right.
So it was co-ed and has been ever since because of John Cage.
So when you're going out there, I mean, you have this person from Oberlin telling you, you know, if you're interested, this is what you should look, you know, this is something mm-hmm. you should look into.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, were you, like, how invested were you in, like, the idea of doing this kind of, like, you talked about, like, doing these things that kind of piqued your interest, right? But,
mm-hmm,
like,
mm-hmm.
going out there and doing a two-year, like, a full two-year program, like, at a place where that's kind of it. That's what you do.
Yeah.
It's a similar kind of, like, we're just saying about, like, this kind of, I mean, obviously, when you're 22-ish, or between 22 and 24, like, nothing is really set in stone. But when you're that age, it sure seems like things are.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You know, so what was kind of your feel? I mean, did you feel out of place? Like,
you know, among
these, like, supposed, like, experts in like with degrees and being weird with music.
I thought back to the class that I had with Randy Coleman and thought there was a lot of similarity in the structure, the openness, the progressive nature of the classes and the discussions that happened in the classes. It was really open. It was really like fertile ground for interesting conversations, interesting concepts kind of being invented mm-hmm. all the time. So I have to say, I mean, that made me feel at ease. That's where my heart is. I really love the feeling of being in a think tank or brainstorming or ideas just swirling around all the time. And I don't have to have something to grab onto. And, you know, for once in my life, it didn't matter how I played the trombone. Mm-hmm. I could just show up and maybe I'm going to play the trombone a traditional way today, or maybe I'm going to play the trombone in a totally different way I've never done before because this composer wants that or this. And so it created an ideal situation for me. I know it's not the same thing for everybody. And it's the kind of school where it definitely rewards people who are self-directed and motivated. And it's less rewarding to people that aren't absolutely dedicated to jumping in and trying stuff out.
Yeah.
You know, because you could just kind of slide by and get a degree and it's not that hard.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, what was really amazing were the students. Most of the students that were there were super invested, and there were a lot of people there that were 10 years older than me that had had performing careers, touring abroad, and so they're bringing a lot of other ideas into our classroom that about what it means to be a professional musician.
I mean, a place like that is not a place, you know. a lot of time, like, and there's like absolutely nothing wrong with this kind of thing, but like a school like some state schools like Ohio State or even private schools like Rutgers or Northwestern, you've got people who are doing degrees in music and just because that's what they were good at and they just assume that's what they should do. If you're at a place like Mills, like, you're there because you looked for
it.
Oh,
God, yeah.
Because it's not a place like you're not gonna see it immortalized in a film like you will Juilliard or hear about it on TV like you will a place like USC or California more like use California like UC USC UCLA which both have good music programs
or
in different
ways.
San Francisco Conservatory,
yeah, which is just across the bay.
Exactly. If you're at Mills, you're there because you had a very specific interest.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, definitely. And then there's UC Berkeley. Actually, those mm-hmm. those so all the formal music is taken care of in the Bay Area, and so that's you can go there if you want to study formal music. But if you want to do something that's off the beaten track and find some new way to incorporate either your talents or create new talents.
Mm-hmm.
That's the place.
So let's set up this kind of framework. Let's kind of fast forward through like some of the following years. Briefly, like, I mean, because you were there for what? Were you there for only 2 years?
I was there only 2 years.
You know, so
how did you... I completed the program.
Yeah, you did. You didn't quit after 2 weeks. Did you still have a job at Starbucks?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, I quit Starbucks.
Well, you know, you could go anywhere. I wouldn't do that. You know, what was kind of filled the interim between finishing there and coming to New York? I mean, that's how many years was that? That would have been
12, 13 years or something like that.
Yeah, that's a pretty big, I guess that's more than an interim.
Yeah. Well, I'd say there's three big chunk phases.
Mm-hmm.
The first chunk was actually a year, but the other two chunks were bigger. The first phase was, I took time off. I needed to assimilate everything. And I'll go back to this and fill it in. The second phase was I stayed in the Bay Area, and I played, I freelanced, I focused a lot on improvisation and playing new music and recording, and then moved to New York and have been here ever since.
Mm-hmm.
So to go back to that first, so after grad school, I mean, I loved every moment of it and I absorbed everything. But at the end of it, there was definitely, the drawback was that I had way too many ideas floating around in my head and I couldn't tell what mine were apart from what other people's ideas were.
Right. And in such a environment like that, like with so many great minds that have gone through a place like that, like and it, new music is a thing that's very what's the word I'm looking for? It's very very personalized.
Yeah.
People come different composers, yes, and performers are very personalized in what they do. Like a guy, you know, and even with something like multiphonics, like different people have very personalized ways that they do multiphonics.
Absolutely.
Like, and so, you know, you come around like getting so all these ideas, like you can kind of lose yourself in other people's ideas.
Sure.
When kind of the point is that you come up with your own. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, that's hopefully, you know, if I'm going to be calling myself a composer or mm-hmm. an improviser, I'm using original ideas. At least that's what my goal is.
Right.
And I don't mind, you know, grabbing ideas from other people, but I want it to be, you know, it's like plagiarism. You can mention when you use someone's idea, but you can't just take somebody's idea and right. use that idea.
You can't make a career on, well, I mean, you can make a career. It's called being an orchestral trombone player. You can make a career on other people's stuff. But, man, back to just like shitting on orchestras. Says the guy who's auditioning for two orchestras next month. You know, whatever. Paycheck's a paycheck. Anyway, you said the first part where you took a year.
Took a year off. I traveled a little bit and took a couple months, actually 2 months without playing the trombone. Came back to the trombone later that year and taught a little bit, took auditions. I mean, here's what's the ironic thing is that I auditioned my best that year out of all the times that I've auditioned. I finalist in a regional orchestra and felt pretty good about where I was going with it, and then later decided that wasn't going to be my cup of tea. But you know, it was good therapy going to Mills, because then I was able to assess where I was going with mm-hmm. with the trombone, and was actually able to put my feet under my ground, under my body, and be grounded with it.
So the music scene in San Francisco, obviously it's like a very strong arts culture, very strong counter, like has always been strong counterculturally.
Definitely.
You know, so I would imagine that that's a good,
yeah.
Without having any like actual intimate knowledge of the music scene in the Bay Area, San Francisco, Oakland, like I would imagine that it, like this like new experimental techniques and like this kind of stuff is a place that this is a place that it's welcomed.
For sure. Yeah. It's funny that it's always evolving. And I think I was there at a good moment in time, and it seemed like there were several venues that were supporting your, you know, any kind of project that you want to bring in. You know, as long as you have a concept and you have the people you want to play with, they'll put you on. And some of them were similar to like Living Room concert series, or maybe even a little better than that, with good soundproofing and good, you know, a good atmosphere. I really enjoyed that part of it. There's a good chunk of people that acted in a community oriented way. There was also a chunk of people that kind of were at odds and I shouldn't say were, because they probably still are at odds with one another, or just, you know, conflicting, let's call it aesthetics that cause one to not be able to respect the other. That is unfortunate, because we're talking about a very niche community in the first place.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
and I wouldn't be, you know, I kind of personally kind of stayed out of it. I think there was a listserv of sorts that, you know, people would kind of rant, a little bit like Facebook, except isolated.
Oh, God, listserv.
Right? I mean, we're talking about a while ago.
Yeah.
Which I never got on. I heard about it. I would hear people talking about the arguments and the fights going on. But it was generally just a really wonderful place to be.
So how did you, like, as far as your own personal, like, individual development, like, what did you... You know, looking back on it now,
mm-hmm.
you know, like 10 years, you know, in the future, what, 10 years later, like, how do you feel that kind of affected your personal, like, the growth of your kind of, like, musical voice? as you.
Well.
Or even just like your interest in like furthering knowledge of the techniques that you were, you know, mm-hmm. that were in your tool bag, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's a really pleasant place to live, California.
Yeah.
It's very comfortable, and the quality of living is good.
Yeah.
Food is cheap, and it's organic, and it's grown right outside your back door, and your clean air, the air smells sweet when you walk down the sidewalks. You know, a lot of things are very comfortable that we can't take for granted here in New York. And,
first off, I prefer my food with chemicals in it. I love my fried chicken from across the street. And if I don't smell garbage, I feel like something's wrong.
Oh, hey, God. You know, so, to each his own. There should be somebody who loves the smell of garbage.
Gotta love the Bronx. Yeah. Yep.
And, yeah, so it provided a really good, comfortable place to experiment.
Now, you're emphasizing, really emphasizing the word comfortable here. And I have to, like, I mean,
you want to talk about that?
I'm just like, you're emphasizing enough to be like, was the relative comfort, like, a detrimental thing? Did it end up being a detrimental thing, you know, the longer you were there? Because, you know, it can be...
It's funny, you picked up on it, that the reason, one of the reasons that I started looking for a place to move to toward the end of my time there was because I'd realized how complacent I'd become. And, you know, I had these great ideas. I was like, yeah, I'm going to develop multifunctionals. I'm going to work on this, but I don't know what I was going to do yet. And I was mostly just working with composers, commissioning works. And I had a solo, I created a solo album, and I toured with that a little bit. And I had some ideas to do with, to work with other people. And, you know, it's kind of chatting around the idea that I was developing multifunctionals. But I didn't sink my teeth into it, and I have a real strong suspicion that it was because it was just very comfortable to live in California, and I really miss it every single day, but I knew I needed to stoke the flame a little bit for myself, and maybe I just needed to up the odds a little bit. I don't know why. Because I'm already a trombone player. But, you know, so I decided, I mean, I'm kind of fast-forwarding faster here. But I decided that I really wanted to pursue something a little different. I was looking at Berlin. I was looking at New York. I was also thinking about doing a Indonesian classical music program, which would take me away from the trombone altogether. So I was thinking about a few things on three different continents. And... a couple things came through with New York at the same time. I had a gig here for a month, so I was in town, and then a group, Asphalt Orchestra, started, and I was asked to perform with the group. So I figured, well, it's a good time as any. Might as well just move.
Well, and... yeah. Why not?
Why not? So, but, it, you know, the time I spent in the Bay Area was... I spent a good amount of time freelancing, for sure, doing working, you know, services. But the time I spent improvising and playing with we'll call them creative musicians. I don't mean to slight those who don't play improvised music at all, but for lack of a better way to think of it, people who compose and also improvise and perform on their instruments. It was just great doing that. I have yet to find myself embedded in a community that is as great here in New York, even though I've played with a lot of really awesome composer, improviser, performers, and I have actually been a part of a couple of collectives that approach that level and that feeling.
I don't know. You'd be able to speak to this better than I would, but probably, but it just feels like there's nothing, no matter, unless you're talking about, like the big classical ensembles, like, nothing really ever really feels stable.
In New York. I agree.
Like, I mean, even like, well-established, mm-hmm. really good ensembles mm-hmm. that do new music and new, like, it's always kind of a crapshoot. like people like develop their own things. It's just you can never. It's never gonna be. Well, it's never gonna be as comfortable to use that. And I don't know. I don't know that it should be necessarily. It's just a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's neither better nor worse per se. It's mm-hmm. just a different, completely different thing. So as like a trombone player in New York, let's you know, you move here. I mean, you already have like a lot of experience. You know, when you came here, you already had a lot of experience mm-hmm. with this kind of thing. Did you find some of the same kind of I don't want to say petty infighting. difficulties in integrating yourself into, you know, you've been here for 7 years.
I would say so for sure. You know, it's really interesting now looking back, you know, a lot of teachers I heard talking to their studios, whatever instrument they were, they would say, make sure you go to a graduate school in a city where you want to live.
Yeah.
And, you know, I thought about that and definitely was part of my decision to move to the Bay Area. But I wasn't really thinking hard about it when I did my master's. not that hard. And so moving here after finishing school somewhere else was actually challenging. I realized quickly that most other people I was meeting had real instant communities, whether they were people who loved them or not,
mm-hmm.
but people who went to school with them and had known them a long enough time to say, yeah, I know this person. So it took some time to feel like I still feel like I'm getting involved. I'm still connecting, and maybe that feeling never ends. but also I should just pull in this idea here that working on this book, especially this last year, but maybe for about 2 years, kind of pulled me away from really going out there and doing freelance work,
hitting the pavement,
or meeting people and whatever it takes to find work. I didn't use my energy that way. I was using my energy to write a book. So so it, in a way, that took me away from
mm-hmm.
the experience of, you know, immersing yourself.
So. Well, like, let's take this whole thing and segue it into talking about the book more specifically.
Sure.
Why there are a lot of techniques that go into, let's say, 21st century trombone playing.
Sure thing.
A lot, you know, a lot of really strange things. I mean, I was just up, you know, what, you know, like doing filming Will. Playing, you know, recording his album, and you were there, and like, those weren't even crazy. Some of the crazier pieces that he's done, mm-hmm. and there's a lot involved. Like, a lot of really difficult, intense stuff involved.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, multiphonics is only one of those things. It's like it's a very specific paintbrush, I guess you could say.
Yeah. Well,
you can use it in a lot of ways with a lot of colors. But it's still just one
mm-hmm.
thing.
Mm-hmm.
Why go so specifically in on multiphonics?
Well, to start off, I just want to say that there's tons of extended techniques, and a lot of those extended techniques are things that we can just do instantly. You know, you describe me a sound, and I can just do it. I describe you a sound, and you can just do it. It's not something that requires a whole lot of skill other than, you know, maybe a little bit of muscle memory and, I got to pull the trigger while I'm doing this with my slide sort of thing, you know. But those are technical, and we're used to learning technical
things. And even if it's a little bit, a little bit strange use in a passage, you take 15 minutes, you can work it out and do it every time.
Exactly. And to just stay away from multiphonics for one more second, what I find to be, besides multiphonics, the most difficult thing to do is when you have to coordinate multiples of those extended techniques.
Right.
So again, that's a different skill set, and it's usually based specific to the piece. However, whichever extended techniques have to be played at the same time. So, to go back to Multiphonics, this is actually...
Oh, and in the unlikely event that there is someone listening who doesn't know anything about what Multiphonics are, it's just the concept of playing one note and singing another note, whether a but, like, just on the very, very basic level.
Yeah,
like, exactly. There's much more, like, there's more to it than that.
Yep.
When you go, like, go into it hard. But, yeah, basically it's playing one note and singing
Absolutely.
Another note. Okay.
Yeah. Good.
Just to get that out of the way.
It's good, important stuff. So, I went really deep into Multiphonics for a couple reasons. I was having a hard time communicating with composers all of the many things that I could do when I was working with composers. I usually would work... I love commissioning new pieces, mm-hmm. and working with composers one-on-one is the best way to ensure that your ideas are going to be properly communicated. So it's often that I'll record a few sounds for a composer to use in their piece and describe to them what it is and maybe what they need to do to write what that technique is. But it's gotten to the point where there's just so many different things you can do on the trombone with Multiphonics that doing that with each composer can be really, it's limiting to what I think of at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want composers necessarily to be skewed in what I think of at the time. So I can't think of this whole book's worth of ideas in an hour long session.
Right.
I'm not going to. I'll think of what I think is cool at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like in an improviserly sort of state, coming up with sounds that I think that the composer might like.
Yeah, I had to do that one time, and I found it was so much harder than I expected to, like,
really,
like, sit down with a composer and be like, oh, here's these things, just like on the spot. Like, I didn't really think about it ahead of time, and it was just kind of like, oh shit, I guess this is something I have to do now. Like,
yeah, there's
what the fuck, what do I do?
These instruments.
Anyway, yeah. Because, like, composers are stupid. They don't know anything about trombone. I mean, they're not stupid. That's me being snarky. But, like, but them not knowing much about trombone is at least is sometimes a fair statement.
Yeah.
Like,
there's
I barely know anything about trombone.
There's
and I
nothing,
play the fucking thing.
There's nothing out there that's going to lead composers to have any concept of what sounds
right.
can be created. There's some extended techniques described in you know, but they're very vague.
Very, very vague, very few, very far between,
yeah,
because
exactly.
They're based off of like five pieces from 1960
1970. Yeah. So usually what you see are composers who are trombone players,
mm-hmm.
and they're succeeding in writing some pretty cool music. Or you find composers who have worked with a trombone player, and they're succeeding in writing some really good, cool trombone music. But what if you're a composer who hasn't played the trombone and you're not around any trombone players? So anyway, that's why I went so far and deep into this concept of Multiphonics. And to just finish, that breadth of sounds that can be made orally, it's a very, very obvious distinction.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about vague, or we're not talking about little minutiae of sound. We're talking about big, huge differences of sound. So it's a whole world unto itself.
Right. And I guess I should have specified that you do cover other techniques besides Multiphonics.
Absolutely.
In this book. Like, yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, I shouldn't, I've been going like hard in on the Multiphonics thing.
Well, it goes hard into Multiphonics, but, you know, there are definitely a few other techniques that, because they blend well with Multiphonics, that's kind of why I wanted to use them.
Right, okay, well, but, I mean, there's a bunch of ways you could have done this, though. Like,
absolutely.
You know, you didn't have to, like, you didn't necessarily have to write a book. You could have done this as part of, like, a doctoral thesis.
Sure, I could have done that.
You know?
I sure could have.
You could have basically just kind of put shit together and self-published it. Like, that's become, like, a method that's become increasingly easy, you know, as the years go by. Like, it's
definitely
super easy to put out your own book now. I mean, that doesn't mean it's going to be good, but you know what I mean? But you made the decision to like go in a in a direction where, in a very traditional direction as far as putting at, you know, spending time like doing, you know,
putting a cover on it, putting a back on it. It has an ISBN.
It has an ISBN. You have you have quotes from people on the back.
Quotes from people.
Like you have
there's a forward.
There's a forward. There's like, you know, it's actually well designed. It's like pretty white paper, et cetera, et cetera. But no. But you
all right, this time.
Yeah. So, but like, why? What drove you in the direction of like really? When there's a bunch of ways you could have put together a resource. There's like, I guess that's what I'm trying to say. There's a lot of different ways you could have put together a resource for composers, even if it was just for, like, you could have made something that similar to this that you, for composers' purposes and other trombonists, of course. And you could have just kind of shared it word of mouth, basically. Sure. And I mean, obviously that probably wouldn't have profited much, but that's not a guarantee no matter what.
Yeah, that's a good point. Depressing. That's a super good point.
But like, why really go? Because this is more work for sure.
Oh, it's so, like, much more work.
It's, you know, the other things I just mentioned would have been a lot less work. But this is like
four and a half years, actually.
Yeah, so. that's totally what I meant to say. Yeah. Well, so this is a 4.5 year project, and you know, and they're all sitting here in boxes here in your living room area.
Yep.
You know, and so this is the result of your almost 5 years of work.
Yeah, yeah.
First of all, that's gotta feel weird.
It is. It is like, so weird.
Like you're sitting here.
It's really weird.
You're not like buried in the work of writing and editing. Yeah. Now you're just sitting here on your couch looking.
I'm looking at all these boxes,
and you're like, oh, so that. Let me ask you this: is there any feeling of, well, fuck, that's it? Like.
Kind of.
I mean,
but
this is my baby, and this is all it is.
It's cool, you know. I'm still pretty happy about it. Like,
oh,
like
of course, I didn't mean that in a pejorative sense at all.
Oh, I didn't mean it that way either. I guess, well, first of all, it's not it because I'm having to ship this stuff out, and that is not a small chore, as it turns out. Holy crap! I didn't know that was going to be a whole other phase. I thought it was just going to happen by itself.
Yeah,
they're just going to walk out the door, go in the mailbox. That doesn't happen.
So why go for the extra work and the this? And I mean, it's a better look for you professionally, that's for sure.
There's a couple things. I guess I wanted to that helps helping me look good professionally. I think it definitely helps, and definitely was part of the motivation for writing it. Because I didn't want to get a doctorate, and I know that that is something that people look at with a certain amount of, they think you are credible, they think you are a legitimate teacher, and I happen to really love teaching, and that's a big surprise to me. I didn't know that when I was in school, but I happen to really, really love it, and I really happily teach, you know, when I'm teaching. So I could see one day being able to teach. Right now I'm an adjunct at one college, but I'm hoping to do more than that.
I mean, and this is the sort of thing that you could having it like an officially published like resource like this. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you know, that in some ways that can be the amount of work that you did on it, you know, mm-hmm. and having it well reviewed by, you know, by peers. Like that can be enough to get you a job that otherwise you'd have to have a doctorate to get. You know what I mean?
I do know what you mean, and I hope that that's true.
That's the idea.
yeah, I hope that that's true. I mean, it's really, I lost my train of thought here. I know I had something good.
It happens to me like literally every single episode I record.
Oh God, I bet. There's so many ideas floating around. Well, I wanted, you know, there's another aspect of this that part of the reason I wanted it in a book form, as formalized as it is that new music is just not taken seriously as much as jazz and classical in many university departments across the country. I don't know much about the European schools, but definitely in this country, what I see are the classical department and the jazz department, and once in a while the contemporary music department will have its own contingent, but it's usually either separated between the jazz and classical, or it's connected to one or the other.
Or it's in a fucking dingy room, yeah, like hidden from sight.
Yeah, and you know, I've heard this is a really sad but true thing. I've heard a lot of time and time again, presenters or booking managers would hire new music musicians for something because they'll play for less. And that's a fallacy. It's a total fallacy. And it's really, so I see this illegitimization of new music happening constantly because people don't understand what it is. They don't understand how hard people work for it. And they don't understand that it's really actually a very challenging thing. And the reason people are doing it is because they are loving the challenge.
Not because they weren't good enough.
Because they're actually looking for something that challenges them.
That's probably the most pervasive thing,
yeah,
in, you know, among people who are more, you know, and I think it's not nearly as pervasive as it probably once was, but you still, you know, you run into people, and it's a little bit perpetuated by people like in conservatories where people are doing the new music ensemble because they're not expected, because it's music that no one knows, the standards, yeah, aren't as high because no one's gonna like really, you know, you can get shit on for not playing Lemaire well. They're probably not gonna shit on you if you kind of like futz your way through a group improvisation session or
yeah,
you know, if you're doing,
or you get
the point. Yeah, you get the point that I'm making.
Or, you know, if you happen to be doing like a Stockhausen piece, you know, there are a lot of
There's a lot of really, really poorly performed new music.
Yeah, absolutely. In schools. And, you know, it's true, you can get away with it because, but if you have a good conductor, you're not going to get away with it.
But that's,
if you have a good ensemble, you're not going to get away with it.
But that's the, those are the, especially, point is like striking out against the illegitimization, like you said, yeah, of new music. That makes sense. Yeah. Because like there's not that many textbooks and conservatories, even among conservatories, it's a little bit like you might not have the best faculty for it, and you might not, like, you'll have somebody, right, there'll be some, right, ensemble, but I mean, like, across the country and like state universities, like they don't have access to the same artists. Like, it's hard to, right, get someone. Yeah. It's hard to get, like, you're not going to get a headliner in the new music scene in a big city to come to fucking Oklahoma, yeah, or, yeah, you know, you Texas, probably, sure, California, like different schools in California. Right. But if you live in Minnesota, you're, yeah, going to have to get by with like some dudes who do some new music around town and might, you know,
right, but they probably form their basis of performing in,
and they probably are, I mean, they're, yeah, and they're probably good,
yeah,
like, because that's, yeah, what they chose, but also, like, it's just, it's not the same, like, it's anyway, yeah. So, like, I guess I kind of say that I can't understand. I mean, I do a lot of work for what I do,
mm-hmm,
but it's not the same, like, this goes in spurts, mm, you know, because, like, past 9 days, I think you're the fifth one I've done in the last fifth Dang. Interview I've done in the last 9 days, and I think I have a couple more next week, but I'll go like 6 weeks without, I'll, yeah, do some, and you know, I you know, the social media thing is a pain in the ass, but you know, I've been doing it for a year,
mm-hmm,
right,
mm-hmm.
But trying to balance like a performing career along with like doing the research, like, how did you, I mean, you did mention that over the past 2 years, like the last 2 years,
yeah.
We played an orchestra gig together around Easter, and you had basically kind of just
we're just putting the finishing touches.
That's right.
Like the very final that's finishing right. touches, editing wise and getting it published and all that stuff, right? And you were telling me about working your way back into kind of
into
like
playing
into
more.
Play, you know, yeah, into being yeah. one of the, you know, just someone that you see on a like a monthly basis because you're playing around, you know.
Right.
Was that something you expected when you started, you know, starting to go into it? Was it like what, you know, was it a specific decision you made 2 years ago to like, okay, I just, you know, I've been doing this for the past 2.5 years. Mm-hmm. But I'm at a point where I have to only do this now. And was that a hard decision, basically? Was that was a struggle?
All good questions. I mean, you know, when I first started doing the book, I mean, it was just piecemeal. And, you know, I say 4.5 years, but maybe the first year or two was like every 4 months or so. Mm-hmm. I'd do some work and then I'd forget about it. Or I maintained the work when it happened.
Right.
And I always deferred to, you know, if I had a gig. Well, I shouldn't say always. I mean, I didn't take every single gig, but I tried to take as many as possible.
As feasible, yeah.
Yeah, as feasible, because there were some days where it just was clear that I needed to spend 8-10 hours on the book, and doing an 8-hour gig would really be a bad idea at that moment. So, but you know, at first, I didn't have to make those decisions very often, because at first I was really thankful to have this idea, this concept of a book, because anytime I didn't have work for a while, I just worked on the book, so I basically was busy all the time, and that was edifying, because my level of productivity, I guess, maintained even if work came and went. So as work started to increase for me, because you know, by that point, when I started this, I guess it was my second or third year in New York. So, you know, I was still kind of getting to know people and stuff. So, as time has progressed and I've gotten to know some people and I have left for a couple tours and had to kind of leave this behind for a while, I found that it was a really cool buddy. It was like the perfect buddy that whenever I was, like, oh man, well, I'm not going to have work for a couple weeks. What am I going to do? Oh, I'll work on my book. Done. Yeah, so, I mean, that's done now. So I guess really now all I have left is to hit the ground and...
You sound so depressed. You're sending your kid off to college and now you're like, you've got an empty nest and you're like, oh no.
No, it's, you know, what's funny is I've got about 5,000 ideas right now. I've got a couple of recording projects that I'm so excited now I can finally invest in. One of them's happening in the silo on the farm where I grew up, where my parents live. It's a silo, in case people don't know, it's a grain container. It's a cylindrical container.
Everyone's seen a silo, just not everyone knows what it's called.
Yeah, I guess so.
Like,
yeah.
If you know.
And they're usually like 80 to 100 feet high. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're made of metal, sometimes they're made of concrete, and this one is made out of concrete. So... It's a really wonderful sound, and there's a nostalgia for me. There's a real importance for me to be using that space and working with that resonance. So that's one project, and I've got a couple of other groups that I'm composing for and want to play with more regularly. So so now that the book is done, it's not like I'm just gonna hit the pavement and look for work. I'm probably gonna keep doing some more creative projects.
I've been kind of making like pretty broad generalizations about like a lot of things
too.
but I mean because there's so much more to there's just more to things than it's like possible
to talk about
in what will probably end up being like, you know, an hour and 15 minutes, you know. It's just not possible to hit everything.
Absolutely.
But as far as like the actual, so when did you like finish this the first, like what you thought was finished?
Probably a year ago.
Okay.
Close to a year ago.
So like, I'm just curious a little bit about the process of going from, okay, I'm done, or I think I'm done.
You want to know about that?
Yeah, of course I do. Because it's like a fucking,
That's the...
It's the nasty part.
Oh man, you're in for it now.
But no, I mean, like, because.
Okay, well, I.
Well, like I said, like it's I know several people who have either put out books like mm-hmm. on their own, like self did it,
mm-hmm.
And people who are planning on doing it, mm-hmm. and people who are interested in kind of, I'm just, you know, like. What was the process like for you? Because obviously you hadn't done this before.
I would say that a year ago when I thought I was finished was the halfway point in the amount of hours that I had put in.
Ah!
And this past year was me just hustling my butt off. I have no idea how I worked as hard as I did this year. I didn't take a day off for a year. 7 days a week I was working. And I would start the day, as long as I didn't have a gig to get to, I started the day working on the book. I ended the day working on the book every single day. And however much time I had in between, I was working on it. Because what happened when I thought I was done was I ran it past basically three editors. One who kind of helped me organize my thoughts and get things into closer, better chunks. The second one who helped me with technical ideas and maintaining just real cohesion. And then third one, which was actually the big doozy, which he nailed me on my grammar. He nailed me on I'm using too many I's, I'm using too many U's, I'm using too many the's. I basically had to just rewrite the whole thing. And hundreds and hundreds awesome. Of hours later... We're talking hundreds of hours afterwards. Then I submitted the whole thing, and I got permissions from, I don't know, 10, 15 people, because you have to get permission to use people's quotes. I had to have permission just to use this cover art, which, like, I mean, the person who did it for me, she did it for me. She made this cover art, but I had to have, like,
written.
her words
yeah.
that said her she gives me permission for it. All of that later, then the formatting process began, and that actually went on for almost 6 months, the formatting process, and that was just a lot of back and forth. That was the publisher would send me what they thought I wanted, and I would freak out because it looked awful, and I would call them up and I'd say, "What the hell did you do to my book? This is awful. It's in cursive. How did you put it in cursive?" And they're like, oh, okay, well, let's change some things here. Let's fix some things. I think it looks pretty good, actually. And I look at it again, and I'm just like, are you cross-eyed? Do you not see what I'm seeing?
And in that kind of a situation, you have to be... you have to be willing to hold out until it's exactly what you want.
Yes.
Because I would imagine it would be so easy to be like... I'm just ready for this to be over.
Oh yeah.
Like if I just say yes, it can all be over.
Oh yeah.
And it might not look exactly how I want it, but it's good enough.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean that got increasingly tempting as the revisions went through. There was a revision point where they finally explained to me the reason it was taking 2 weeks at a time
uh-huh.
is because the person I was sending it to had to then send it to the formatters who might not be on the same time zone or continent. So they'd be working different hours. And for some reason it takes 2 more weeks, I don't know, to get back to me. Whenever I would complain about it, they'd say, well, I mean, we have 700 authors we're working with. And I'm like, well, but time allocation, I mean, don't you do that? Don't you do time you allocate time to people who have paid for your service?
Yeah.
I'm not sure how it works. It's obviously a black hole, and every person I've talked to who's published a book has talked about this black hole. So, thankfully, I'm not the only one. But it was honestly about the most aggravating part.
Was there ever a point where you, like, not even so much frustration, but like just was there? Well, I mean, out of frustration, but also where it was like. Where you had made up your mind to say yes and someone talked you out of it? Or was it, did you, like, you know, like, how close did you come to just, like, hitting the go button?
You know, I became my own best inner critic I had to, like, I listened to the devil and I listened to the angel on both sides of my shoulders, and they were fighting tooth and nail at each other. Oh my God, they ripped my ears apart. But seriously though, I really had to keep back up and keep my thoughts in check. And I actually researched what published books have. Apparently every published book has mistakes. Mm-hmm. So I looked up what that ratio is per page, you know. And when I found that, I kind of fell into the zone of what's acceptable to even the most harsh critics of, of, you know, finding mistakes. I was like, well, okay, I think I'm all right. I don't know if it matters or not, but just to give you a number, they said that if it's 3 mistakes per 10,000 words or fewer, then you're fine, as long as it's not something really major.
As long as it doesn't, like, change the meaning of it.
Yeah, yeah, as long as you're not doing something that's... exactly. So we're talking about minutia. We're talking about probably 3 or 4 little, like, 1 or 2 character typos each. Yeah. And while I still cringe, I feel it in my shoulders are cringing, my little devil and angel are fighting. Yeah, I know where they are. I totally know where they are. But it's not so bad. It's not bad, and, you know, I mean, I've read through that thing so many times.
Well, and plus,
and didn't see them.
Like, I'm sure we've both, like, found, we've both looked at, like, trombone books that are garbage.
Yeah.
Like, absolute, like,
yeah, you can't read the notes,
I actually like this book a lot, but the Aharoni method for bass trombone.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know what the fuck they were doing. That book is garbage. It's a good book, the stuff that's in there is all good, but it looks like shit. Yeah. I don't know what they're, you know, like.
And why'd they have to make it this size? Why did they have to make it
so fucking big? I know.
It doesn't fit on any bookshelf. Mine's sitting across, horizontal up there somewhere.
Yeah, exactly. Like that fucking giant yellow, urine yellow book. I don't, like, who okayed that? Like, does he?
And it's this chalky texture. Yeah, so weird. Like, why would you make a book that anyway feels that way?
But I will vouch for the listeners that your book does not look anything like that. It's very well sized. It can fit on any, like, you know, well, not this bookshelf. Okay, it'll fit down here. And the, like I said earlier, the pages are very nice and white, and it's very easy to read. It works very nice. And this chapter 4 starts with the words Gary Greenhow, who was a trombone dude who made things and valves and then went out of business. Which is depressing. But anyway.
It's totally depressing.
Do you play a Greenhow horn?
I have a Greenhow horn. Okay. I went to Gary Greenhow's house. Oh, that's why chapter 4 starts with Gary Greenhow.
Yeah, okay. Well, I didn't. Obviously, I didn't read past the first, you know.
Well, you'll have a chance, I'm sure, at some point.
I'm sure. holding yourself up to the standard of other trombone books.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a pretty low bar to clear, is all I'm saying. even the good ones.
Fair enough.
Even the good ones. But of course it's never bad to be exacting.
You know, I someone very can't think of the word right now. So someone actually had the presence of mind, we'll say that, to suggest that I look at other contemporary instrumental books and see what their layouts were like and use that as my my stepping stone for putting this format together. So I did start with that. I looked at his first name evades me right now. Turetsky wrote a double bass contemporary method book for extended techniques. And Robert Dick wrote, similarly, a book for flute players. So I looked at those and got some ideas from that. And actually, I got ideas from one trombone book, Bradley Edwards, actually. Bradley Edwards' Lipsler's book. I just love the layout of it.
It's on my music stand.
It's just clean. It's there's nothing. It's just
It's clean.
There's nothing extra about it. It's just easy to read, and that's what you need when you're looking on a music stand. Yeah. If you're looking at music or if
nice
you're...
bright white paper and easy to read.
Yeah. So I tried to fashion after that a little bit and use formats that I kind of saw that other new music instrumentalists had used. Tried to make sense out of it that way.
So, I mean, are you happy with it?
Yeah, you know, what is that? Like,
I mean, you could lie to me. It's totally fine.
I've had it for like a week. I mean, I'm still getting my head around it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I had to let other people do. Like, I didn't get to do the binding. I didn't get to, I mean, I'm not an artist, so I couldn't do the cover art and the font. And, you know, so there's a lot of stuff that I'm still getting my head around because I had to just basically delegate those jobs to other people. And I guess maybe I'm not that kind of person usually.
Mm-hmm. What are kind of your plans going forward? With whether that's, do you have places where it will be sold? Do you, what kind of arrangements do you have? Is it kind of be just, I don't know. I don't know how these things work. Well, I don't know what, I'm not sure like what your plan, what are your plans for?
Well, I mean, I'm learning too. And it, you know, the what's really important to me is this gets into the hands of people who need this information. So, I'm pitching it to school music libraries, and I'm also letting composers know about it. I'm letting trombone players know about it. It's a little bit word of mouthy, and it's a little bit of cold calling as far as the music libraries go. And I feel like at this point I'm just gonna let that take its time, however much time it takes, because at this point I don't have a goal anymore. It's done. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to do anything by a certain time, and that's a really big relief, because now really what that means is I'm focusing, like I mentioned before, I'm going to focus on other projects that have been kind of sitting on my shelves. It's kind of looking at me forlornly, and just kind of pick away at it and let people know, like, bit by bit, I think. This past year I actually gave some talks,
mm-hmm.
at a new music, I guess it's a festival, a new music festival in Czech Republic last August. I gave a talk to composers, like the whole composer class. And, over this past year, a couple of trombone workshops, and, most recently at Jim Pugh's Complete Trombonist Workshop, which is kind of a new thing. This is only the second year he's ever done that, and he's going to continue doing that program, which is great for college students, maybe high school students, and just really motivated people who want to find out more about classical jazz and beyond, Mm-hmm. So I'm working bit by bit with composers and with trombone players, and that's what I'm going to continue to do. So now I've got this book to kind of help move that along, maybe quicker. Maybe they get a chance to look at the book before I talk to them, or however it works out. I'm just going to let it happen the way it works.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, like the hard shit's done.
Yep.
Awesome. Well, where can people get it now?
They can buy it from my website, jenbakersounds.com. And, or you can talk to me personally. Send me an email if you think you're going to see me in the neighborhood. I'm in Brooklyn. So I'm more than happy to carry it with me in my backpack wherever I'm going. So, I can hook it up.
That's funny.
That's about it, though, so far. I'm realizing distribution for Europe and maybe South America would be really nice. I've shipped some overseas now at this point, and realizing that, holy cow.
It's expensive.
Yeah, they're going to have to pay the same price in shipping as they're going to pay for the book, and that's not, I don't think that's fair. It's not fun, at least.
It's not fun. I don't know. I mean, fair.
Fair.
I mean,
okay.
It is going across oceans.
It's going across oceans. Okay, fine. Well, but anyway, it would be nice to, I would like to find a European distributor for sure, and maybe one in South America.
Yeah. Fantastic. So. Thank you for sitting and talking to me.
It's a pleasure, Dan.
Happy that we could do this.
Let's do it again sometime.
Yeah. Just gonna record every time we talk from now on. That's all. Okay. That's the only way I talk extemporaneously now.
That's great. Yeah.